A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hannah sent us this one. She says she learned about the Maya and Aztec as if they were one and the same in school, and she's having trouble keeping the details straight. She wants to know what we actually know about both civilizations, how advanced they were, what technologies they had, what daily life looked like. And she flags something important up front. The Maya continue today. That's not a footnote. That changes how we study them.
It changes everything. And Hannah is not alone in this confusion. I'd say most people who went through a standard curriculum got them blended into this kind of generic pyramid people category. You see it everywhere. Museum exhibits that lump them together, documentaries that use the same B-roll of Chichen Itza, whether they're talking about the Maya or the Aztecs, even though Chichen Itza itself sits at this fascinating intersection where both cultures actually did brush up against each other in the post-classic. But here's the starting fact that should rewire your brain. The Maya Classic period peaked around 250 to 900 CE in the Yucatan lowlands. The Aztec Empire rose in the Valley of Mexico around 1428 CE. That's nearly 500 years after the Maya political collapse. They never coexisted as civilizations at their height.
It's like conflating the Roman Empire with, what, the Holy Roman Empire? Except the geography is wrong, too. The Maya were centered in what's now Guatemala and southern Mexico. The Aztecs were 1,200 kilometers northwest in the Valley of Mexico. That's roughly the distance from London to Rome. You wouldn't casually merge those two.
Different time, different place, different political structure. The Maya were never a unified empire. They were a network of independent city-states. Tikal, Calakmul, Palenque, Copan, sharing a culture, a writing system, a calendar, but constantly warring and allying with each other. Think of it like ancient Greece, shared language, shared gods, shared cultural touchstones, but politically fractured into rivalrous city-states that would fight each other one generation and intermarry their royal families the next. The Aztecs were a triple alliance empire with a single capital, Tenochtitlan, tributary system, centralized military, the whole imperial apparatus. If the Maya were Greece, the Aztecs were Rome, a single dominant power that extracted tribute from subjugated peoples across a vast territory.
We've got decentralized city-states versus a centralized empire. That structural difference shapes everything else. How they built, how they governed, how they recorded history, how they fell. Let's walk through this in three layers. The engineering and cities, then the writing and knowledge systems, then daily life, and what it means that one of these civilizations is still here.
We should start with the engineering, because this is where both civilizations did things that genuinely should not have been possible, given their technological constraints.
No pack animals, no metal tools, no wheel for transport. Let's sit with that for a second. No horses, no oxen, no donkeys, no iron chisels or bronze saws. And the wheel. They actually did have wheels. We've found wheeled toys, little ceramic animals on axles. But without draft animals to pull carts, the wheel never scaled up for transport. So everything, every block of limestone, every basket of earth, every sack of maize, moved on human backs.
The Maya built their entire world with human muscle and stone tools. And they built at scale. Let me give you the numbers on Tikal. At its peak in the 8th century, Tikal housed somewhere between 60,000 and 90,000 people. It's in the middle of a rainforest with no natural water source, no river, no lake. So they built massive reservoirs called aguadas, lined with clay and waterproof plaster, to capture and store rainwater. These weren't small ponds. The palace reservoir at Tikal held something like 74,000 cubic meters of water. That's roughly 30 Olympic swimming pools, carved and lined by hand.
This is the part where your ears perk up, because there's a filtration story here.
In 2020, a team published findings and scientific reports about the Corriental Reservoir at Tikal. They found that the Maya had lined it with zeolite, That's a volcanic mineral that removes toxins, heavy metals, and microbial contaminants. It's the oldest known water filtration system in the Western Hemisphere. And they didn't stumble onto this. Zeolite doesn't occur naturally at Tikal. They quarried it from a site about 30 kilometers away and transported it intentionally. Think about what that implies. They had to identify that this particular rock, from this particular quarry, had purification properties. That's not trial and error on a small scale. That's systematic knowledge about material properties.
1500 years before we figured out activated carbon filters, the Maya are trucking volcanic minerals through the jungle to purify their drinking water. That's not mystical ancient wisdom. That's engineering. And it raises a question. How do you even discover that? What's the chain of observation that leads you to say, hey, let's haul this specific rock 30 kilometers and line our water tanks with it?
We don't know. That's the honest answer. Someone, somewhere in the Maya world, noticed that water filtered through zeolite-rich areas was cleaner, or that certain volcanic deposits kept water fresher longer, and that knowledge spread. The Maya didn't write technical manuals, at least none that survived, so we're reverse engineering their discoveries from the physical evidence they left behind.
Their transportation infrastructure was equally impressive. They built Sakbiob, white roads, raised limestone causeways that connected city centers, sometimes for dozens of kilometers. The longest known Sakbe runs 100 kilometers from Koba to Yaksuna. These weren't dirt paths. They were engineered roads raised above the forest floor, plastered with limestone that reflected moonlight.
That moonlight detail isn't just poetic. A white road visible at night has practical implications for travel in a hot climate. You can move goods and people in the cooler nighttime hours. It extends the usable day. That's thoughtful design.
Of course there are. And then LIDAR changed everything.
LIDAR changed everything. For listeners who aren't familiar, LIDAR is basically laser scanning from aircraft. It strips away vegetation digitally and reveals the bare ground surface. In 2018, aerial surveys of northern Guatemala revealed over 60,000 previously unknown Maya structures. Houses, palaces, defensive walls, irrigation canals, terraced fields. The landscape was far more densely populated and interconnected than anyone had imagined. We're talking about a continuous urbanized landscape with millions of people, not isolated cities in a jungle. Some estimates now put the Maya population at its peak between 10 and 15 million people. That's comparable to the population of France in the same period.
Let me pause on that number, because it's staggering. 10 to 15 million people in a tropical rainforest, without metal tools or pack animals, building cities that we're still discovering. What does that do to our assumptions about what civilization requires?
It dismantles them. The old model said you need certain preconditions for urban civilization, usually a dry river valley, like Egypt or Mesopotamia, where irrigation is straightforward and the landscape is open. The Maya built a densely urbanized civilization in one of the most challenging environments on Earth, a tropical rainforest with poor soils, seasonal drought, and no navigable rivers in many areas. They didn't overcome the jungle, they engineered within it, working with the landscape rather than against it.
Let's pivot to the Aztecs. They faced a completely different engineering challenge. They built their capital on an island in the middle of a lake.
Tenochtitlan, in 1519, had a population of roughly 200,000 to 250,000 people. To put that in perspective, that's larger than Paris or London at the same time, larger than any European city. And it's on an island in a high-altitude lake basin. How do you feed that many people? How do you keep them from flooding? How do you supply fresh water when you're surrounded by brackish lake water? Everyone calls them floating gardens. They weren't floating. They were raised agricultural beds built on shallow lake beds. You'd stake out a rectangular area, fence it with woven reeds, layer mud, and decaying vegetation until it rose above the water level, and plant willow trees at the corners to anchor it. A single acre of Chinampa could feed 20 people, and they could get up to 7 harvests per year. Maize, beans, squash, amaranth.
7 harvests a year on a single acre. That's the kind of productivity that makes an imperial capital possible. But how does that work in practice? How do you sustain that without depleting the soil?
The lake itself is the answer. The Chinampas sat between canals, and the canal water wicked up into the planting beds from below, providing constant irrigation. the farmers would periodically dredge the canals and spread the nutrient-rich muck onto the beds, essentially renewing the soil every season. You've got a self-fertilizing, self-irrigating system that never goes fallow. It's arguably one of the most productive agricultural systems ever devised.
The scale of it.
By 1519, the Chinampa system around Tenochtitlan covered 9,000 hectares, and the engineering doesn't stop there. The city was connected to the mainland by four main causeways with removable wooden bridges, so they could isolate the city during an attack. There was an aqueduct system that brought fresh water from springs on the mainland, running along one of the causeways. And in 1449, under the ruler Nezahualcoyotl, they built a 16-kilometer dike across the lake to separate the fresh water from the brackish water, preventing floods and protecting the drinking supply. This dike was wide enough to walk on, with sluice gates to control water flow. It's a piece of hydrological engineering that any Renaissance engineer would have been proud of.
A 16-kilometer stone dike across a lake, built without draft animals or metal. Let's contrast the approaches here, because it's revealing. The Maya solved water and agriculture on a city-by-city basis. Tikal built reservoirs. Palenque built aqueducts. Each city-state adapted to its local terrain. The Aztecs built imperial-scale infrastructure, dikes, causeways, Chinampa zones managed from the center.
That's the decentralization versus centralization distinction in physical form, and both approaches worked brilliantly in their contexts. The Maya system was resilient. If one city-state's water system failed, the whole civilization didn't collapse. The Aztec system was efficient. You could mobilize massive labor for projects no single city-state could attempt. But it was also fragile. Cut off Tenochtitlan, and the whole empire unravels.
Which is, of course, exactly what happened.
In 1521, yes. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. The point is, neither of these civilizations was primitive in any meaningful sense. They were solving complex engineering problems with the materials available, and in some cases, the zeolite filtration, the Chinampa productivity. They developed solutions we're only now studying for modern applications. There are agricultural researchers in Mexico today actively working to revive Chinampa techniques because they outperform conventional farming in terms of yield per acre without chemical inputs.
We've seen how differently these two civilizations approached engineering at scale. But what about how they thought about time, history, and the cosmos? That's where things get really interesting, and where the confusion between them runs deepest.
This is where I get excited, because the Maya writing system is one of the greatest intellectual achievements in human history. It's one of only three or four independent inventions of writing, alongside Sumerian cuneiform, Chinese, and possibly Egyptian hieroglyphs. Nobody taught the Maya how to write. They figured it out from scratch. And they didn't just develop a simple pictographic system. They developed a fully functional logosyllabic script capable of recording anything you could say.
We almost lost it entirely.
The Maya script is logosyllabic, roughly 800 glyphs that represent both whole words and individual syllables. It's fully capable of recording any spoken Mayan language. But for centuries after the Spanish conquest, scholars assumed the glyphs were purely calendrical or religious symbols, not real writing. The breakthrough came in the 1950s when a Soviet linguist named Yuri Norisov proved the script was phonetic. Then in the 70s and 80s, Linda Shelley, David Stewart, and others did the painstaking work of decipherment. As of today, we can read about 80 to 90% of Maya glyphs.
What did we learn once we could actually read what the Maya wrote?
That they were recording dynastic history, the names of individual scribes and sculptors. One inscription at Copan names the sculptor who carved a particular stela. It's like finding an artist's signature. These weren't mystical stargazers. They were politicians, propagandists, historians. The glyphs tell us who conquered whom, who was captured, who performed which ritual on which date. It is a historical record. And not just kings. We find records of queens, of noble women who held significant political power. Lady Six Sky at Naranjo, Lady Cable at El Peruaca. These were not passive figures.
Then there are the calendars.
Three interlocking systems. The Dzogchen, a 260-day ritual calendar. The Hab, a 365-day solar calendar. And the Long Count, a linear count of days from a starting point in 3114 BCE. The Dzogchen and Hab interlock like gears. Any given day has both a Dzogchen and a Hab designation, and that combination repeats every 52 years. The long count is what gave us the 2012 apocalypse, Nonsense.
Which was what exactly? An odometer rolling over?
The long count measures time in units. KN is 1 day, Weinol is 20 days, Tun is 360 days, Kaotun is about 20 years, Baktun is about 394 years. On December 21st, 2012, the 13th Baktun ended. That's it. It's like your car hitting 100,000 miles. The Maya themselves carved inscriptions projecting dates thousands of years into the future. The Temple of the Inscriptions at Palenque records a date in 4072 CE. They clearly didn't think the world was ending. The 2012 myth originated in a 1975 book by Michael Coe, who speculated about Armageddon, and the internet ran with it.
The glockenspiel of corporate approachability.
I'm sorry?
Just noting the pattern. One scholar muses, pop culture turns it into a blockbuster. The Aztec writing system, different entirely.
The Aztecs used pictographic codices, folded bark paper books with images that recorded tribute lists, historical narratives, ritual calendars. It was a mnemonic system, not a full writing system like the Maya script. You couldn't record an arbitrary sentence in Aztec pictographs the way you could in Maya glyphs. The images prompted a trained reader who already knew the story.
It's more like a visual aid for oral tradition than a writing system, like a PowerPoint deck that only makes sense if you were at the meeting.
That's the scholarly consensus, yes. And here's the tragedy. The Aztecs had an enormous library of these codices. The Spanish burned the Library of Texcoco in 1525, one of the greatest acts of cultural destruction in history. What we know about pre-contact Aztec life comes largely from codices produced after the conquest, when Spanish friars worked with Aztec scribes to record their history.
The Florentine Codex.
The Florentine Codex, compiled between 1545 and 1590 by the Franciscan friar Bernardino de Sahagún. It's 2,400 pages. An ethnographic encyclopedia of Aztec life, written in Nahuatl with Spanish translations and illustrations by indigenous artists. It covers everything. Religion, social structure, medicine, botany, conquest history. Without it, we'd know almost nothing. And it's worth noting that Sahagún's method was unusual for his time. He didn't just observe from the outside. He trained Aztec scribes to conduct interviews with elders and record their answers in their own language. It's arguably the first modern ethnographic project.
Then there's the object everyone thinks is a calendar.
The Aztec sunstone. Discovered in 1790 in Mexico City's main plaza, carved from basalt in the early 1500s, weighs 24 metric tons. It is not a calendar. It's a ceremonial altar depicting the five world ages, the five suns. The central face is most likely the earth god Tlaltecutli, not a sun god. The concentric rings show the previous four worlds that were destroyed and the current fifth sun. It's a cosmogonic monument, not a timekeeping device.
The Maya independently invented writing, the concept of zero, and a calendar system more sophisticated than anything in Europe at the time. The Aztecs produced the Florentine Codex and built Tenochtitlan. And yet the popular image of both is... what? People in featherhead dresses doing sacrifices on pyramids?
The sacrifice question deserves its own treatment because this is another area where the Spanish sources massively exaggerated. The conquistadors had a strong incentive to paint the Aztecs as bloodthirsty savages. It justified the conquest. Most modern estimates suggest Aztec human sacrifice numbered in the hundreds per year, not the tens of thousands claimed by Spanish chroniclers. And the Maya practiced sacrifice too, but on an even smaller scale, and mostly in the context of royal bloodletting rituals rather than mass ceremonies. Maya kings and queens would pierce their tongues or genitals with stingray spines and offer the blood to the gods. It was intimate, personal, and deeply theological.
It's worth naming the pattern here. When you're trying to justify conquering and converting a civilization, you highlight the most alien and horrifying practices, strip them of their theological context, and inflate the numbers.
That framing has persisted for 500 years. You still see it in documentaries and textbooks. Meanwhile, we gloss over the engineering, the writing, the astronomy, the agriculture. We define these civilizations by their most extreme ritual practices, rather than by how they fed their people, organized their cities, and recorded their history.
That's the technology. But technology doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's shaped by how people live. So let's talk about daily life in these two worlds.
Let's start with the Maya. Maya society was hierarchical, but not rigidly so. At the top, you had the Kiahuil Ajaw, the divine lord, and the royal court. Below them, a noble class of scribes, priests, military leaders, and administrators. Then the vast majority, farmers, artisans, merchants, laborers. At the bottom, enslaved people, usually war captives. But the interesting thing is that Maya city-states were relatively small. Even Tikal at its peak was maybe 90,000 people. So the distance between a farmer and a noble was not vast in physical terms. They lived in the same city, participated in the same public rituals. The king wasn't a distant figure in a palace far away. He was visible, performing bloodletting ceremonies on the temple steps while everyone watched.
What did a typical Maya farmer's life look like?
Milpa agriculture, the slash-and-burn cultivation of maize, beans, and squash together, what we now call the Three Sisters. The maize provides a stalk for the beans to climb. The beans fix nitrogen in the soil. The squash spreads out and suppresses weeds. It's an elegantly co-evolved system. A Maya farmer would also hunt deer, peccary, and turkey, and gather wild plants. Houses were oval structures of pole and thatch, with packed earth floors. Extended families lived in compounds around a central patio. And everyone, nobles included, participated in the ballgame.
That's one of those things that shows up in both civilizations, right?
Both, but with different rules and meanings. The Maya ballgame was played on a stone eye-shaped court with sloping sides. Players used their hips, thighs, and forearms to keep a solid rubber ball in play. No hands, no feet. It was both sport and ritual, and the stakes could be life or death. Some carvings show captive kings being sacrificed after a rigged game, but for most people it was probably just sport, the Mesoamerican equivalent of football. And the ball itself is worth mentioning. Solid rubber, heavy, painful to get hit by. The Maya had been processing rubber for thousands of years, mixing latex from rubber trees with juice from morning glory vines to create a material with just the right bounce.
What about the Aztec side? Daily life in Tenochtitlan?
Tenochtitlan was an urban marvel. The city was divided into four quarters, each subdivided into smaller neighborhoods called calpulli. These were the basic social units, something between a clan and a district council. Each calpulli had its own temple, school, and marketplace. Education was compulsory for all children, boys and girls, nobles and commoners. That's right, the Aztecs had universal public education in the 15th century.
Wait, compulsory education for everyone?
The Telpokali was the school for commoners, focused on practical skills and military training. The Calmacoc was for nobles and gifted commoners, focused on priesthood, administration, writing, astronomy. Both boys and girls attended school, though in separate institutions. And literacy, in the sense of being able to read pictographic codices, was widespread among the noble class. This is one of those facts that should make you reconsider everything you thought you knew. 15th century Tenochtitlan had higher literacy rates than much of rural Europe at the same time.
That's surprising. Most people imagine the Aztecs as a warrior culture first and foremost.
They were a warrior culture, but they were also an administrative empire that needed literate bureaucrats to manage tribute, trade, and diplomacy. You can't run an empire of millions without record-keeping. Tenochtitlan had a massive central marketplace at Tlatelolco that Spanish chroniclers claimed could hold 60,000 people. Merchants called Pochteca operated long-distance trade routes across the empire, bringing back jade, cacao, feathers, gold. Cacao beans were used as currency. The economy was sophisticated. There were judges, courts, a legal system. If you stole from a merchant in the marketplace, you'd face a tribunal.
The social structure.
More rigid than the Maya. At the top, the Huey Tlatoani, the great speaker, the emperor. Below him, the Pipiltan nobility, who held all the high offices. Then the Masehualtan, commoners who farmed, crafted, traded, and fought. Below them, the Mayaguez, landless serfs tied to noble estates. And at the bottom, enslaved people who could own property and buy their freedom, which is notably different from chattel slavery as practiced in the Atlantic world. An enslaved person in Aztec society could marry, own goods, and their children were born free.
Corn is staple crop for both, obviously, but what about the food culture?
Maize was central for both, but the Aztecs had a much more varied urban food scene. The Chinampas produced not just maize, but tomatoes, chilies, avocados, amaranth, squash, beans. They cultivated spirulina algae from the lake as a protein supplement. They'd skim it off the surface, dry it into cakes, and eat it. They ate dogs, a specific breed called Exaloitsquintli, and turkeys. And they had chocolate. Cacao was so valuable it was used as money. The Maya drank chocolate too, but for the Aztecs it was the drink of the elite, often mixed with chilies and spices. The Maya preferred it frothy, poured from height between vessels to create a foam on top, which, if you think about it, is basically the world's first cappuccino ritual.
The Maya are drinking their artisanal pour-over cacao, and the Aztecs are using it to pay rent. All of this raises a question that doesn't get asked enough. If the Maya are still here, why do we talk about them in the past tense?
This is the most important point Hannah raised, and it's the one that fundamentally separates Maya studies from Aztec studies. There are 6 to 7 million Maya people alive today in Mexico, Guatemala, Belize, and Honduras. They speak over 30 Mayan languages, Quiché, Yucatec, Quiché, Mam, and many others. The classic period political system collapsed, yes, but Maya people did not disappear. They didn't go anywhere. And this isn't just a matter of distant descendants. There are communities in highland Guatemala today where the Zolk'in calendar is still tracked by daykeepers, where traditional weaving patterns encode cosmological knowledge, where the languages spoken are direct descendants of the languages carved on those classic periods stelae.
That changes the archaeology.
When you excavate a Maya site, you're not digging up a dead civilization. You're working in communities where people still speak descendant languages, still practice versions of the same agricultural techniques, still use the same calendar in some highland regions. Modern Maya communities are partners in archaeological research, not just bystanders. They bring linguistic knowledge that helps decipher glyphs, agricultural knowledge that explains how the terraces and raised fields worked, cultural knowledge that interprets ritual practices. A modern Maya farmer can look at an ancient terrace and tell you exactly how it was built and why, because their family has been building terraces the same way for generations.
The Aztec legacy is different. Nahua people, the descendants of the Aztecs, still live in Mexico, over 2 million of them, still speaking Nahuatl. But the imperial structure was completely destroyed. Tenochtitlan is buried under Mexico City. The codices were burned. The continuity was broken in a way that didn't happen for the Maya, partly because the Maya were more decentralized and harder to fully conquer. It took the Spanish nearly 200 years to subdue the last independent Maya kingdom.
The last Maya city, Nochpetén, modern-day Flores in Guatemala, didn't fall until 1697. That's almost 2 centuries after Tenochtitlan. And Maya resistance continued into the 20th century. The Cass War of Yucatan in the 1800s was a full-scale Maya uprising that nearly drove out the Mexican government. The Zapatista movement in Chiapas in the 1990s drew heavily on Maya identity and grievances that traced directly back to the conquest. So the Maya narrative isn't just ancient history, it's a continuous thread running right through to contemporary politics.
The Maya narrative isn't mysterious lost civilization. It's continuous civilization that has been actively resisting erasure for 500 years.
That reframes everything. The Maya calendar didn't end in 2012. Maya daykeepers still use the Zolk'in today. Maya languages didn't die out. They're spoken by millions. The Maya didn't abandon their cities. The political system fragmented and people moved, but they never vanished. When you walk through a Maya community in Guatemala today and hear Quechis being spoken, you're hearing a language that has been spoken continuously in that region for well over 2,000 years. That is an extraordinary fact that should reshape how we talk about the Maya entirely.
Before we wrap up, let's pull back and ask, what can we actually learn from these civilizations today?
2 very practical things. First, water management. The Maya zeolite filtration system at Tikal is being studied by modern engineers for applications in regions without access to industrial water treatment. It's low-tech, locally sourceable, and effective. The Aztec Chinampa system is being revived in parts of Mexico as a model of sustainable intensive agriculture. No chemical fertilizers, no fossil fuel inputs, incredible productivity. In Xochimilco, on the southern edge of Mexico City, chinampas are still farmed today, and there are projects working to restore abandoned ones. These aren't museum pieces. They're living laboratories.
Second, the intellectual legacy. The Maya independently invented zero. The earliest known zero date in the Americas is on Stela II at Chiapa de Corzo from 36 BCE. That's a mathematical concept that emerged independently in only a handful of places in human history. And the decipherment of Maya writing is one of the great scholarly achievements of the 20th century. done largely by a Soviet linguist who never set foot in Mesoamerica, working from drawings in a library in Leningrad.
He figured out that Diego de Landa, a 16th century Spanish bishop who burned Maya books, had also, ironically, recorded a partial Maya alphabet in his writings. Landa had asked Maya scribes how to write Spanish letters, and they'd given him the syllabic equivalents. Norisov realized Landa's alphabet was actually a syllabary, and that cracked the code. The man who destroyed Maya texts inadvertently preserved the key to reading them.
That's either cosmic irony or the universe has a very dark sense of humor.
If listeners want to go deeper, I'd recommend The Maya by Michael Coe, the same Coe who started the 2012 thing, but his textbook is still the standard introduction. Charles Mann's 1491 is essential for understanding the pre-contact Americas more broadly. And for the Aztecs, the Florentine Codex is available online through the World Digital Library. You can literally look at the pages Sahagún scribes painted 500 years ago. It's free, it's searchable, and it's one of the most remarkable documents in human history.
If you want to see these places, Tikal in Guatemala, Palenque in Chiapas, both UNESCO World Heritage Sites, Tikal's temples rise above the rainforest canopy. You can climb Temple 4 and watch the sun rise over a sea of green with the tops of other pyramids poking through. It's one of those experiences that rewires your sense of scale, and you'll hear howler monkeys roaring in the distance, which sounds like something out of a dinosaur movie. It's one of the most transporting places on Earth.
The open question that keeps me up at night, what else is still buried? LIDAR is revealing Maya sites at a rate of thousands per year. Every time they fly a new survey, the map gets denser. And in Mexico City, every metro expansion, every building foundation, keeps turning up Aztec artifacts. The Templo Mayor, the main temple of Tenochtitlan, was discovered in 1978 by electrical workers digging near the cathedral. It's still being excavated. We are nowhere near the full picture. There are probably entire city centers under the jungle canopy that we haven't found yet.
As climate change strains water supplies and agricultural systems, these ancient engineering solutions are getting a second look. Maya reservoirs, Aztec chinampas, these weren't just historical curiosities. They were working solutions to problems we're facing again. The chinampa system in particular is being studied as a model for feeding urban populations without the environmental costs of industrial agriculture.
The Maya and Aztec were not interchangeable. They were distinct civilizations with different political structures, different writing systems, different engineering approaches, different fates. The Maya were a network of city-states with a fully developed writing system that endured for over 2,000 years and continues today. The Aztecs built a centralized empire with a single magnificent capital that lasted less than a century before contact. Both were brilliant, neither was primitive, and one of them is still here.
Hannah, here's your mental model. Maya equals decentralized city-states, full writing, jungle lowlands, still here. Aztec equals centralized empire, pictographic codices, Highland Lake City, conquered in 1521. They're separated by 500 years and 1,000 kilometers. They never met. And if you remember nothing else, remember that the Maya didn't vanish. They're still here, still speaking their languages, still farming their land, still keeping their calendar. That's not a footnote. That's the whole story.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1953, a geological survey of the Simpson Desert in Australia misattributed elevated sulfur dioxide readings to a dormant volcanic vent, a finding that was later corrected in 1958 when researchers realized the gas was actually seeping from a buried coal seam that had been smoldering underground for an estimated 6,000 years.
A 6,000-year underground fire? That's unsettling.
That's going to sit with me.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, rate the show and tell a friend. And if you have a question that's been nagging at you like Hannah's was, send us your Weird Prompt.
We'll be here.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.